This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 13. Tonight we're going to be talking about back to basics and exactly what the basics are. Before we get into that, I thought we'd just kind of talk about one short current event thing, which is .NET 3.5 SP1 and also Visual Studio 2008 SP1 have shipped. We talked about those before, several episodes back, when they hit beta. The client profile sounds cool at 24 megabytes instead of 200 and whatever it is. I installed it on a virtual machine running XP Service Pack 2, and it really did only take 24 megabytes, so that was pretty neat.
The thing that I thought was funny about the client profile is if you go and download the full install for the client profile, not the bootstrap install, it's actually bigger than the full framework. It's like 255 megs compared to the full framework's 197 megs. So I Twittered about that, and I still don't quite understand why that's the case, but maybe there's some fancier install logic in there, but it just struck me as a bit
odd.
When
you wrote that, the only thing I could come up with was that maybe it was due to targeting specific clients, and so there's an XP client profile and a 2003 client profile and all that, and so it's, since it's fine-tuned for each machine, maybe the individual installs are smaller, but the one that has to install on any machine is bigger. Yeah, that is weird. I don't know. I recently looked at Silverlight for Mac, and the install there is like 17 megabytes, and on Windows, it's 4.5. Who knows how much overlap there is? I bet there's similar code, but under the hood, there's quite a bit different.
Well, the 4.5 Silverlight install, I think on Windows, requires you to have .NET installed already, maybe?
I don't think so.
No? No? Huh. What other topics do we have? Knoll launched, I remember.
What's that?
Knoll.
Oh.
Google Wikipedia. Google does this a lot. They launch things, and then you go, why? Like the Google, you know, Orkut, that social network that they bought.
Yeah. And I think then they go, why, a little bit later, too. Like they just, they're kind of in the throw mud on the wall and see what sticks and whatever. And if something gets popular, maybe they'll update it, and maybe they won't.
What is the name of this again?
K-N-O-L. Knoll. Or Knoll. Or Knoll.
You know, I think that's maybe a problem that Google's had recently, is that they've lost their way as far as great-sounding, like, brandable names. Google is just rolls off your tongue, kind of, and it's memorable and all that. Haiku, spelled J-A-I-K-U, is not something people remember. Knoll is not either. Orkut, I guess.
Well, apparently the Knoll, a unit of knowledge. So they're trying to play off of...
I don't know.
I got two Knolls out of that presentation, but I'm still at -4 Knoll, or -4 Igs.
And you're only at +2 Charisma, too, so...
Yeah, but I failed my saving.
I just finally got to their page and just all sorts of strange topics on the front page. Vomiting in infants. Occult gastrointestinal bleeding.
It's like Wikipedia threw up. They must have just gotten the doctors on board because, by God, there's a lot of medical topics.
What I think is great is that the first answer for KNOL on Google is Wikipedia, and it's a Wikipedia article about KNOL, and after that is the Knoll, whatever. Is there a pronunciation key? Jeff Atwood was saying that he thinks that the reason for this is just that Google's got to be a little scared that Wikipedia is kind of displacing Google as the start page of the internet, in that a lot of the time if you want to find information, you're gonna look at Wikipedia, and if not, you may Google it, but the first answer is going to be Wikipedia, and you'll go straight there. And it's a non-profit. It's not really an ad revenue place for Google to make anything off of. So maybe this is a response to that. Then again, maybe it's just a, hey, let's do another project and see what happens. let's go on to this topic of back to basics. There's been a lot of conversation recently about getting back to basics and talking about design patterns. And personally, I didn't have a comp sci degree, and I kind of learned on the job, as I think a lot of developers do, and later was recommended the book on headfirst design patterns. And I thought it was really, really interesting. Although I haven't completely found application in a lot of the work that I'm working on where I'm not building out actual frameworks. So I'm wondering, do you think design patterns are basic knowledge everyone should have?
So the answer is, as with all computer questions, it depends. If you're building frameworks, if you're building .NET, if you're building Silverlight or an operating system, then there's hardly anything in basic comp sci that isn't applicable. But if you're trying to build, you know, web applications or Twitter clients, or, you know, there's only so much that you're going to get out of basic comp science kind of stuff. And I think there's some basic comp science stuff like big O notation that does help you when you're writing applications. You're using loops and you're doing stuff like this. And then there's other stuff that doesn't really help that much. We kind of covered this in Should People Learn C? And it's kind of the same thing, you know, here with the basics. But kind of trying to figure out what the basics are, and is knowing how to write a linked list passe, and now you need to know when to use dependency injection instead.
Well, I was going to say along those lines about some of the really basic fundamental issues of computer programming. One issue that I saw just come up this week was understanding floating point arithmetic on a computer, where a developer had a floating point number stored in a single precision float, put it into a double precision float, and wondered why the number changed. And that's just one case of an error that, or, you know, a misunderstanding of floating point arithmetic. You'll see, you know, you'll also have people that'll compare two floating point numbers and wonder why they may not be equal, even though the math that got them to that point should have produced a full number. So I think that's one of those fundamentals that's important for people to understand before you even get to things like design patterns or principles.
You either learn that kind of thing in a class, or you learn it by just running into it, and then you ask your friends, hey, what's going on? Or you search around for it and somebody tells you. Hopefully that's something you know ahead of time,
right?
Because that's a hard problem to know about. Like, there's a lot of programming problems where it's really hard to find the answer unless you already know it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. There's just so many things that I've run into that it's like, once you know the answer, it's all totally obvious in retrospect. But as you're working on it, there's just no way you would have guessed. And definitely, like, floating point arithmetic is not something that you'd guess those things would be problems. One thing that I've run into is, and I'm sure we all have, are cases where, you know, they say after you learn design patterns, you kind of use them everywhere and overuse them sometimes. I've definitely worked on projects where, you know, it was a relatively simple project, and it had 30 different, it was a solution with 30 different projects, and you had visitors here and decorators there and all that, and really it could have been a few simple classes. Have you guys had that experience?
Yeah, I've seen that crop up, and then you'll always run into someone who wants to use every single pattern from the Gang of Four book, which is, you know, a couple decades old almost at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen the case too where, you know, somebody is looking at a problem, and the first thing they think of is, okay, I'm going to go to my Gang of Four and see what the appropriate pattern is here, as if it's some sort of, like, recipe book for constructing software. You know, or I think, you know, it's obviously hugely valuable to have some sort of common vocabulary for commonly solved problems, but the Gang of Four book is not a cookbook for, you know, you mix a little of this here and a little bit of that there, and out pops a delicious, you know, software package.
Yeah, I've seen also some work to update design patterns for more modern day things. So you have the very abstract design patterns, which are very much focused on you're dealing with algorithms and you're at a low level. But I've seen some design patterns where people have looked at Ajax design patterns or, you know, client application design patterns or enterprise design patterns, that kind of thing. And I think that's kind of maybe a more useful case, but I don't think that's a lot of the time what people think about when they're saying, I'm getting started, I'm going to learn design patterns. So does anyone here know anything about how to implement Gang of Four patterns in, for instance, JavaScript?
Well, there's a book put out by Apress called Professional JavaScript Design Patterns. Two of the authors, I think they're Googlers. One of them, Dustin Diaz, used to be with Yahoo. And they basically went through and the last three quarters of the book, they spend implementing the Gang of Four patterns in JavaScript and showing how you can use them when you're building these kind of rich internet applications or rich web clients. The first quarter of the book is showing how to encapsulate information in JavaScript objects and how to enforce interfaces so that some of the patterns make more sense, I guess. Or that she, you know, kind of enforced this, not necessarily type safety, but a kind of method calling safety net on your objects. So I don't know if design patterns really even count as basics as much as, you know, things like when to use null checks, when to, you know, I don't know. Cause I don't have a CS degree, so I don't know what them fellers learn in their fancy school.
We should stop at this point. Who here does have a comp sci degree?
I do.
All right. You're out of the club.
All right.
Thank God. What should we know? What should we know, K. Scott?
Learn us some smarts.
Oh, I was thinking, too, there are some more basics that a lot of developers could benefit from that you would probably learn in a comp sci degree and that you probably wouldn't pick up in day-to-day development unless you really sat down and thought about things or researched things. And those are things like memory management, what's the difference between a heap and a stack. And some of this depends on what environment you're in. So, you know, to a JavaScript developer, that might not be so important as it is to a CLR developer. But memory management, heaps versus stacks, references or pointers, I think, are an important concept. And I think that's why a lot of people recommend that schools should be teaching some form of C or C++ instead of jumping right to a managed runtime like Java or something that's on .NET or even something like Ruby. There's something about understanding pointers that just gives you a real, really good understanding of what's happening behind the software. And then a lot of things just make sense and fall into place, like how closures work in JavaScript or how the string is a reference type, but it sort of behaves like a value type. It kind of makes more sense when you think about it. Then when you get past that, I think there are some basic object-oriented principles and basics that are good to learn before you jump into something like design patterns. And again, this depends on your environment, but if you're working in C# or Java, you'd want to know about encapsulation, polymorphism, inheritance. That's maybe not so important if all you're doing is writing JavaScript, but it's good to know for those other languages. And then you can get closer to the design patterns. But even before you get to the design patterns, I think there's some fundamental principles to learn, things like the single responsibility principle. So the idea of designing an object or a class that has a single responsibility so that it's easier to maintain, I think that goes a long way. And having that in the forefront of your mind leads to writing better software than thinking about singletons and factories and visitor patterns and things like that. What do you think, Scott?
So there's kind of two separate things going on here. So we talk about some things, and heap and stack I know are like language implementation details, but so things like how pointers work and how references may work inside of JavaScript or in some other GC language, and how, you know, floating point numbers work and why you can't just compare them willy-nilly. That's kind of a fundamental, how does the hardware work underneath? And that's the hardware reflected in kind of the language implementation, I think. And there's this whole kind of separate thing of, you know, how hash tables get implemented, and that's more of a language implementation, how you do it. SRP and things like that. So do they even teach those things in computer science, I guess? I mean, most of the curriculum that I've looked over, they never really, you know, talk about design, other than here's encapsulation and here's why it's good and things like that. But they don't teach things like single responsibility, or they teach things like the laws of Demeter and what's that, Listkov substitution. Listkov. Yes. But they don't. It never seems like it's in the context of building an application or any kind of production code. It's always a contrived example to explain how it works.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the challenges of a university education, is that anything you're going to write is only going to be around for 3 or 4 months. So a lot of the principles that you might want to apply, you don't really see what the benefit of those principles are in the long run, because you never maintain or modify that stuff. What does Kevin think?
The basics that are important seem like they vary so much based on the context you're in. So the important basics to somebody working on Google's server farm might be very different from the basics that are important to somebody building an internal application for some enterprise software company. Where in one case, you know, absolutely knowing in depth how the bits get twiddled and how the, you know, things are laid out on disk and et cetera is key. That stuff to somebody building an internal application is not particularly important, and it's very unlikely that they will ever, need to know that level. I do think having some sort of general sense of how computers work in that, you know, in at a sort of high level is valuable, just because at some point you end up debugging crazy stuff. But if I'm just writing an internal application for 10 people, it might be far more important that I understand good maintainability principles than I understand algorithmic complexity of so-and-so.
Right. I think that's really key in that I think that a lot of the time people will think, okay, the hardest, most low-level stuff is all the pointers and the data structures and MapReduce and, that kind of level. It's like take it way down to the algorithms and the comp size stuff. And then they'll say, if you get that, you can figure all the other stuff out. And I think that that's not at all the case. I think that there's plenty of people that are misapplying technology, partly because they're not willing to move to higher levels of abstraction. So my concern, and I don't know, I mean, this is just a hunch, but my hunch is that people will say, okay, the low level is where it's at, and abstraction is for wimps, and so, you know, and so they'll want to stay at the lower level, and you end up with worse software for it. I don't know how you teach this in a school other than having people with some practice in the real world in there, but they'd say, look, here's a pointer, here's the disk, here's how you hit it, here's this stuff. Now, we're not going to do that. We're going to go up a level, and you're going to work with a framework. And if you're hitting, if you're doing bit twiddling to make your corporate internet work, you're probably doing something wrong. Like, it's not just that you don't have to do it. You shouldn't do that, you know? And so I think that that's kind of my concern with a lot of the back to basics approaches, is the whole understanding of what exactly is the basics.
And I think in the vast majority of cases, when a project fails, it's not because somebody didn't know how to apply a left shift operator correctly to optimize multiplication. It's far more likely it's because requirements weren't translated correctly, or somebody didn't talk to the right person when they were defining the needs for this application. Now, obviously, there's exceptions to that, Google being the typical example. But applying the right knowledge at the right time, I think
we're talking about specialization and how it's important to look at the context of what you're learning and what you're applying. And so I was looking around at some of the comp sci curriculums, and I am seeing that, you know, there's the comp sci approaches, but there's also like language technologies or software engineering or robotics or like there's game development, that kind of thing. I don't see a lot of courses in, or I don't think that they have like minors in web development, although I think that that's, people might look at that as too much of a trade school approach, but in reality, that's what people do. There's a heck of a lot of web development out there, or enterprise software development, or that kind of thing. And maybe that would be something that, as long as it's not too trade school-y, that could be actually really useful to our profession. Okay, Scott?
Yeah, my education was a little bit dated now, but you know, thinking back to those days, I had, for instance, a course in data structures. I think I actually had at least two semesters of data structures, which these days no one writes things like list of T from scratch or a dictionary class from scratch. I mean, those are all built into the frameworks. But I think it's still worthwhile to understand how those things work, but certainly the amount of time that we spent on those topics sort of overemphasized them from an implementation point of view. There were a lot of topics that I never encountered in school, in college, or even in a master's degree that when I got into the real world today, I would find them invaluable. So when I'm interviewing people out of school and I ask them about source control, well, no one uses that in college still. And I think it's very fundamental to our profession and what we need to do. Even if you're a single developer, you should know what source control is and how to use it.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point, is talking about, so what do we think the basics are? Source control is definitely, I think, something that's just a very basic thing that I would argue you should probably even learn day one. You know, you should maybe learn before you start writing code, is where you put the code and how you manage the code. What are some of the other topics that you guys think? I'm thinking it's hard to not contextualize things. So when I think of what developers should know, I automatically assume web development. What do you guys think is important basics for the kind of work that we do? Scott?
There's always a little bit of hesitation to recommend anything because, you know, it'll get abused, kind of like the Gang of Four pattern. So you get patternitis as soon as you learn these things. But it seems like that having a basic understanding kind of how strings kind of work under the hood in the framework of your choice is always a kind of a good thing to understand. Understanding how loops work, and I don't know if maybe that's too basic, but understanding how why it is that you know multiple nested loops can really slow things down, even though you're just kind of pushing things around, and kind of some general techniques on how to speed those up. Normalization. It seems like everywhere I've gone that the self-taught programmers have never really dealt with any kind of database normalization. I lucked out, and one of my first gigs was with a guy who knew databases. So, you know, I didn't have Excel files shoved into SQL Server like a lot of places do. But, you know, understanding how far to normalize and when to not normalize, it would be good. I mean, they talk a lot about, you know, relational algebra and things like that in RDBMSs, but they don't really focus on the hows and whys you might not want to do, it seems like. The basics, you know, the usual OOP, why it's good to have things kind of set out, but maybe more of a focus on how to design objects, what qualifies as an object, or what, you know, because you get to the point where you see, you know, public class, you know, something ID, and you look in there and all it is a holder for an integer, and like, well, you know, that's certainly an object, but That's not an object I need. I have ints for those. I don't need a whole class to hold my integer.
But what if you want to redefine how the integer works? I'm just kidding.
That's just silly, and you ought to get slapped.
Okay, Scott, any thoughts on that?
Well, I was going to turn the question back around on you. So you were kind of looking for recommendations on what a web developer would need, what sort of basics to learn. And I was just thinking, if I was developing some sort of academic curriculum for web developers, and I'm thinking, like, you know, a professor who's just sitting in an office and thinking about lots of theoretical things instead of what's actually happening in the real world. And I'm not trying to slight anybody in that role. It's just, that's education. I'd probably design a class that would start with something maybe that talked about the HTTP protocol and how it worked, and maybe even dip down a little bit into TCP/IP. I mean, those are the kind of things you'd go through at a university.
Right.
Do you think that would be good or bad?
You know, it's hard to say. Early on when I was working with classic ASP, it was helpful to understand the headers. And there have been times where I've gone into Fiddler and where my understanding of headers and the HTTP has been helpful. But it's kind of rare. It is edge cases. And I wonder then for those edge cases, if it is the hard edge cases, that shouldn't be the core curriculum. I was thinking that the thing I'd want to start with if I was teaching web developers is spend a year on a book like The Zen of CSS Design by David Shea and Molly Hirschfeld, or a book like that that talks about really how web browsers work and how CSS is supposed to work. Because I think that we all kind of stumbled through things and just kind of everybody viewed source a lot and read a bunch of web pages and threw a bunch of HTML out until it looked good in the browsers and called it a day. And I think that that's a basic I'd like to see is, I think I wrote my first web page maybe in 94, something like that, you know, and I'm still continually learning more about HTML and CSS and JavaScript and how browsers work and how they should work and what they're doing wrong and all that. And so I just think that there's a lot more there that people just kind of write off as like, oh, great, you're an HTML developer, you know, great, you played with front page a bit or something. So, Scott?
Well, it sort of relates to, you know, this sort of different viewpoints John and I have on like very starting with very practical stuff versus very, you know, theoretical fundamental things. So do you think a book on CSS would be useful, or do you think some sort of, well, you think starting everyone off with a book on CSS and HTML would be useful. Do you think it would be useful to also just talk about separating content from styling? I mean, that's something that could be applied to XAML and Silverlight and also HTML, the CSS relationship.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great way to look. I think the way that HTML and CSS work together are a really, it's a lot deeper than people think about, you know, like it teaches separation of concerns and the value of that. It shows you a way to use inheritance in a way that makes sense to a junior developer, you know, that you're using inheriting and overriding and all that stuff. And so I think that those are some great fundamental concepts. And then from that, you can look at UI and a lot of different things. I think that that's a great fundamental building block. And it's also something that's relevant. You know, it's like how many people, if you just talk to a bunch of people that don't really know much about computers and you start talking data structures, that's not anyone's world. But you talk web pages and it's like, yeah, I get that. You know, view source on YouTube and see how they're doing. And I think that's a great way to, and then build up from there. And obviously, things get very complex, and I wouldn't say that you should just be a HTML jockey, but I think that if you're building web applications, you need to know what you're building. Like, at the end of the day, you're writing out a bunch of strings that browsers are evaluating, and so you need to know what you're doing there.
Yeah, but a lot of the stuff about CSS and that, it's still evolving. It's a moving target. And, you know, it really didn't come into play until, like, what, 2 years ago? 2.5, when the prototype library was released, and suddenly you had a way to you know, you could query JavaScript objects based on, you know, a class that they had applied to them, even if they had multiple classes. You know, you couldn't really do that unless you wanted to just split on the space and kind of iterate over the resulting string array. You couldn't just say, get me, you know, something that has this class.
Right, and that's definitely true from a programmatic point of view. And I'll let you get back to what you're saying, but that's definitely true from a programmatic point of view in JavaScript, but from a point of view of writing out your web pages, we've had HTML and CSS for a long time. Since the late 90s, we've had tags that would let us lay out our HTML a lot better than tables do. So, yes, the tools are evolving, but the fundamental way that HTML and CSS work have been set in stone for a long time, and browsers are catching up to more and more of the features, but the way it works has been there for a while.
Well, and see, that's the problem. The way that it works is still in flux, and you try to set dimensions on an object, and you're going to get different things in IE versus Firefox and versus Safari. Even if you're targeting standards, I'm finding that, you know, Safari just, you know, still doesn't quite get everything right. It's not just as easy as targeting Firefox and standards and having it work everywhere. And so I don't know if that's necessarily fair. You know, it's almost obsoleting their knowledge quicker than I think that it should be. But I can see your point about, you know, CSS and HTML and how to play out your HTML pages and how to structure them so they're more semantic, as, you know, it's kind of a fundamental of web application design.
Kevin?
Yeah, I do think that from a higher level education perspective, I do think it's important that an educational curriculum, at least to some extent, focuses on the sort of the more technology agnostic issues, sort of the higher level issues that are not specific to any technology which may come in and out of vogue. So, you know, understanding these sort of higher order issues like distributed system design and, you know, compiler construction, you know, parser writing. I mean, these are things that are not, you know, specific to a particular technology, but which are sort of universally applicable. And like, I, for example, you know, have a, from a schooling perspective, have a physics and math background, and I know a lot of people in the industry that have that, and I think partly that background teaches you how to solve problems, and that skill translates to technology really well. And so I think having those higher level skills of how do you solve problems, how do you apply these principles, you know, sort of general principles to specific technologies, I think is part of the role of what you learn in school. And so as focusing on that as opposed to learning CSS, you know, focusing on why is separation of concerns good as opposed to the specifics of CSS versus HTML. You know, I think that's valuable to retain that in the educational curriculum.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that solving problems is really what software development is about.
Well, we talked about basics as far as schooling is concerned. Are there basic topics outside of, you know, what you learn in college that we want to cover more?
So, but kind of, you know, doing an internship if you're taking CS as your major, and while, you know, your last semester or last year working in a company and not in an academic necessarily position, I guess, unless that's what you want to go into. So not writing the compiler at, you know, the next VC++ compiler, but, you know, working at Joe Enterprise Company on their intranet, you know, and learning more of the soft skills, the wetware stuff, how to interact, how to gather requirements, what the heck a requirement is, how you know it when you hear it. When do you stop asking why when you're gathering requirements? Things like that.
Okay, Scott.
I was going to say, I think once you get away from technology, then things like communication skills, I think, are basics and keys. Not just being able to communicate verbally and ask questions and listen to questions and being able to communicate with team members, but being able to do written communication too. But, you know, we all send a lot of email and communicate in different mechanisms, but that's pretty critical these days. And then you need, you need to know how to do some political backstabbing to move up the corporate ladder.
Right. That's maybe key. Some role-playing games or, right.
Need proper suck-up technique for getting stuff out of your boss.
What Scott Kuhn said just a minute ago really kind of resonated with something I've been thinking for a while, which is that internships, I think, is a key way to learn things. And I think that, like, for instance, Google Summer of Code or things like that, I think that is just so much more valuable than any kind of curriculum. And from the point of view of hiring somebody, I would definitely look at that and be like, oh, great, you did this internship. What'd you work on? And we'd talk about it. And I'd realize that, okay, they had some grades and they'd finished a curriculum, but also they'd actually worked on a project. Like, they'd actually shipped some code, and that's huge. So I think that's a really key thing. This reminds me of back a long time ago in my Navy days. We were in nuclear power school, and we had a bunch of guys from the Naval Academy who really, like, thought we were pretty tough, you know, and then there are a couple of guys from the Merchant Marine Academy, and we made fun of them and stuff. And then one day we went into a lab, and they said, okay, we've been studying how to parallel these electrical generators, so anyone want to try it? And all of us were just scared, you know, because it's big machine and high voltage and all that. And the guy from Merchant Marine Academy is like, yeah, I'll do it. And he walks up, and it's like, click, click, flip, flip, you know, turning knobs and stuff, and just boom, he was done. And all of us were, like, just speechless and had total respect for the guy. And he's like, I've done that tons of times, you know. I did an internship. Like, he didn't say an internship. He did a cruise. But, and after that, you know, we were totally in awe of the guy. And he was way ahead of us all, you know. And I just think of that with software development, too, that, you know, if somebody's actually shipped some code, they're way ahead of anyone that's just taken classes.
Yeah, especially because there's so much more to shipping product than just writing the code. There's dealing with the documentation and QA and localization issues. And, I mean, simply sitting down and cranking out of the code is often a very small piece of the entire ship product. So, and that's the kind of stuff that you're pretty much only going to learn when you actually do it.
Okay, Scott?
Yeah, not only does that indicate that they've actually gained some practical experience on shipping code, but it also makes them stand out from the crowd, because it's not an internship that most schools isn't something you have to do. And, you know, contributing to an open source project when you're still an undergrad isn't something you have to do. So if you find someone that's actually done that, then they're probably in that, I don't know, 5 to 10% of people that are really passionate about this and are really enjoying software development and want to get started right away. So you probably found someone special when you come across one of those.
All right, so that wraps us up for this week. Come back next week. Thanks.
Live search. What kind of a default is that on a browser?
Live. It's a live search.
We're living. Yeah.
Just go change that to Ask Jeeves, and it'll work fine.
I'm going to set it to Yahoo Search, because damn it, they don't get any love.
Their Alta Vista's making a comeback.
I just wonder about those guys. Like, do they make any money? Are they still running off of funding from, like, 10 years ago?
Oh, my God. Work? Is it still there?
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was, like, did they get bought by Excite or no? Oh, my God, they're still there.
Yeah, but they're showing Google ads.
You know what was surprising to me, by the way? Nobody said anything about the show where we had Scott Kuhn. You were gone from that show, and so we just had... I just pasted in audio from previous weeks that didn't make any sense. And nobody said a word about it. So like, there were things where it was like, so, you know, you could do this, but this programming library is blah, blah, blah. Any thoughts, you know, any thoughts, Scott? And then you would say, like, well, if my car broke, I couldn't fix it. And then, like, then we just went on, and nobody, no comments, nobody said anything. It was weird.
I think they just fast forward through those parts when you say, what do you think, Scott?
Shoot. Scott, you're officially expendable, I think, Scott. We're going to just replace you with the automated Scott.
Record some non-sequiturs, and you can just go on.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I guess that's true. You could have the week off.